From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, theologian Elaine Pagels on why so many people are interested in the apocalypse. Later, the Rotary Club of Milwaukee marks a centennial milestone.
I just think the ideals of Rotary keep it relevant, justifies its existence year in and year out. And I would say today, 100 years later, it's as relevant, if not more.
Plus, a cautionary tale if you're thinking of moving to the country, and a calculated gamble turning a cavern into a concert venue.
We're taking this huge risk. Let's bring a world-famous actor and a phenomenal musician in this cave that we have in Milwaukee. And we think that's great. That's taking risk, and that's doing something that's exciting.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. A massive tornado sweeps through an Oklahoma suburb. A bomb causes mayhem at the Boston Marathon. A gunman kills children at an elementary school, while another kills worshippers at a Sikh temple. They're all tragedies. For some adherents to the Bible's New Testament, though, they are indications of a world moving in an apocalyptic direction. They point to a variety of images from the New Testament's last book, the Book of Revelation. It's a book that's kind of an outlier from the Bible's other, more straightforward messaging, and it's one that author and theologian Elaine Pagels has studied a great deal. Pagels is Harrington Spear Payne Professor of Religion at Princeton University, and her latest book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She was in Wisconsin earlier this year for an event at the Milwaukee Public Library, and I spoke with her on stage then. She started by talking about how her academic interests were informed by her own faith tradition.
Well, that story starts in California. I was brought up there. My family was Protestant, except that my father decided to give it all up for Darwin. He decided that Darwin was right and the Bible was a bunch of old folk tales. And so he had no use for it. And I was told that religion wouldn't survive. I mean, when everybody got educated enough, nobody would ever care about religion anymore. And that was the kind of environment that I heard about religion. Although I was always fascinated and loved the music, the poetry, and so much else. And then when I was about 13, some friends took me to a Billy Graham crusade in San Francisco. And to my parents' horror, I just loved it. The music, this power in the blood of the Lamb, the intensity, it was an extraordinary experience. And I really sort of dove into it, and it opened up many things for me, particularly the power of that kind of religious experience. And I've been asking myself for a long time. I mean, I was in an evangelical group for a year, and those people that I was with read this book with great intensity and great seriousness about the signs of the time. So that's, as you know, one way that many Americans read this book. But I've been asking myself ever since, well, I left that group after about a year for various reasons. And, well, they said that my friend who was Jewish was going to hell. And I thought it was a weird thing to say because Jesus was Jewish. But it didn't seem to count. Anyway, but it had nothing to do with what drew me into it, what I loved about it. So I left and did lots of other things. Yes, I wanted to be a dancer, and I was not good enough to be that kind of professional dancer. So I kept thinking, but there's something else I'm so curious about. What is it about religion, or is it Christianity, that's so compelling and powerful? And that's what I work on.
But along those lines, and you make your living to a large degree studying words that were written, in this case, 2,000 years ago. And I mean, this seems to dovetail nicely with what you just said. What gets you excited about doing this work today and analyzing words that people have been analyzing for two millennia?
Well, people still read these. I mean, the biblical words wouldn't work at all if they weren't so powerful and strange. But also, you know, I went to graduate school thinking I could find out what Jesus really said in some sort of simple way in the hills of Galilee. And then I found out, you know, everything we know about him was written at least a generation later. And it's not so simple. But also, my professors had file cabinets full of gospels I'd never heard of. the Gospel of Thomas, which I was very struck by that, claims to be the secret teachings of Jesus. And I find it very compelling and very moving, and many other texts. And it's enormously complicated, the picture. And now I realize, Pitch, that there are many other revelation texts. I gave a little sample here of hors d'oeuvres of various other revelation texts. But there was an outpouring of them. There wasn't just one. So I was curious about why this one is in the New Testament and the others not.
Well, and that's such an interesting part of this story, because it was really, they were on the fence. This was not a slam dunk, to use an unfortunate sports metaphor. Why was it Athanasius? Why was he successful in including this revelation at the end of the canon and essentially closing the door on anything else that came afterwards?
It's a really good question, and it's not an easy question to answer, because, you know, there were. Christian movement was very vital and alive for 300 years before there was a canon at all. And people did read various books and heard preaching about the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Matthew and so forth, and the Gospel of Thomas. But we didn't have a collection that was a standard collection. And only after the emperor became a Christian, which was a shock to everyone practically, Constantine in the year 312, he had one of his bishops whom he trusted in Palestine, he said, go make 50 copies of the scriptures. And the bishop had to figure out which ones. So there were some books that pretty much everybody read, the Gospels of the New Testament, the letters of Paul. But he made two lists. He said, well, these are the recognized books, and these are the illegitimate books. The only book that's on both lists is the book of Revelation. Because it was so disputed. It's the only book that was intensely debated. Some people said it's irrational, it's crazy, it's not a revelation, it's written by a heretic. And other people said, no, it's written by a follower of Jesus. So there's a huge argument about this particular book.
There are such disturbing images, and yet one of the conclusions to your book is that hope is a key component of the message that we can take from it. Why do you see hope as such an important aspect of what comes out of this, despite it all?
You know, it's part of that other question about how is religion still so compelling today? And I thought the book of Revelation is an interesting test case, because I don't see any ideas in it. There are just these images, and they're the kind of images of the forces of good against the forces of evil. And they're the kind of images you see even in children's literature or movies like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. Forces of good, the forces of evil are about to take over the world, and they have to be fought and so forth. And I think the depth of the power of this book is not about ideas or do you believe in this or that, but it's about hope and it's about fear. It's about what we're afraid of and what we hope for.
One of the most interesting other lessons that we can take from this book, from your book, that is that people have used the book of Revelation, basically since it was written, to support their belief that the bad things they see going on around them represent the end times. Why do you think the end, has been the go-to explanation for people for so long? Why do we have to attach the bad things that are going on around us to this one set of images that we see at the end of the Bible?
Well, that's a good question. It seems to me that, you know, we live in a world of chaotic and often terrible things happening, and people always have, especially when there's war, and there's almost always been war. And so the sense that, is there any meaning out of this chaos and destruction and slaughter and suffering? And this book, like the book of Daniel, claims, yes, there is a meaning. If you get up to heaven and you see it from God's point of view, as John says he was allowed to get glimpses that way, then you see that it's intelligible and that it's going somewhere. And where it's going is not toward total catastrophe. It's going toward a finale, which will be glorious, and the world will be renewed.
I imagine it's a dicey proposition to try to read the motivation of someone who wrote 2,000 years ago. But would you imagine the graphic imagery that makes up Revelation was in part so graphic in order to capture the attention of John's contemporary readers?
Well, I think that's how he actually saw the forces of the Roman Empire and the forces of his own people in that time. But also, you know, he's a Jew writing in an empire where Jesus of Nazareth had been crucified for sedition against Rome, and his followers like Peter and Paul had also been, well, Paul was beheaded and Peter was crucified. I mean, it was very dangerous to oppose the Roman Empire. And so he wrote in oblique language that Jews would understand, because it's the language of the prophets, because they spoke about the foreign armies of Babylonia and Egypt as monsters, and the foreign capitals of the city as whores. And so they would understand that he was talking about Rome and the emperors and very concrete issues, but in a very vivid, dreamlike way that you couldn't pin it down.
But at the same time, there's no point in being subtle.
It wasn't subtle, but what it does allow you to do is to hope that justice will prevail in the world.
I wonder, do you think should it surprise anyone that the kind of fiery rhetoric of Revelation made the cut and ended up in the canon, whereas the more ponderous material, the other books of Revelation that you write about in your book, that ask kind of, that leave things more open-ended, they ended up not in the canon? It seems like the stuff that was kind of definitive would be more likely to survive the years the way it did.
Well, I think the people who loved this book were people who lived in persecution. They were getting arrested. They were seeing their friends tortured and killed. And they wanted a hope that, although the government was invincible, I mean, you couldn't imagine a military response to Rome. You couldn't. I mean, they tried, but couldn't. So they wanted a promise in the book. But also, I think this book presents a way to interpret conflict that really puts whoever's reading it on the right side. I mean, that's why it was important to me to recognize that it's been read on both sides. I mean, I mentioned the war in Iraq, where it was read by people in this country. It was also read by radical Muslims exactly the same way, in reverse. And I think that's kind of dangerous, to have a book that can be read that way. I'm wondering about if we go on reading it that way in the 21st and 22nd centuries, and we can really destroy the world. It's very questionable. So this book, it also talks about who goes into a terrible punishment of fire. And it's very unspecific. John has this vague language. He'll say, oh, well, it's the dogs, the filthy, the evildoers, the sexually deviant, right? And you think, well, who is that? Could be anybody you don't like, really. But it's very different from what you get, say, in the Gospels, where Jesus, according to Matthew, tells the story of who goes into the kingdom of God and who doesn't. The sheep and the goats, that parable, in which he talks about the people invited into the kingdom. It's not that. It's not about what you believe, and it's not about hate speech like the book of Revelation. It's the people who show compassion on those indeed, or people who don't. That's the only question. But that's very different, and that's very specific. It can't be played on both sides.
There's another fascinating aspect to this, and that is when you get into how the book evolved and started bringing in the earliest version of the separation between church and state, if you will. And I thought that it was perhaps an underrated element of the development of Christianity in, I guess, the 4th and 5th century.
That's a really important point that you raised, because, you know, in 2,000 years ago, nobody, whether they were Jewish or Spanish or African or Egyptian or... nobody in the Roman Empire thought you could separate religion and politics, because they were inseparably connected, both for the Romans and for all peoples that they conquered, which are all of those people. And this was a dissident group of Jews who refused to honor the gods of the empire. And of course, they were intensely persecuted for that purpose because they were dangerous. They were setting a precedent, but they didn't set a precedent. I mean, the beginning of the separation of what we call church and state, but religion and politics, starts, I think, with Jews and also then with the followers of Jesus. And it becomes, fortunately, I think, for all of us, part of our traditions. And it seems kind of normal now for many Americans, but for many people in so many parts of the world, it's not even there as a concept. Or hardly.
What to you is still the big question out there, either about the revelations that are in the New Testament or these other revelations that were recorded but have only more recently really begun to be dissected?
Yes, the other books of Revelation are not about the end of the world, and they're not about the Day of Judgment. They're really more like accounts of spiritual breakthrough, like the Revelation of Zostrianus. I just included the Revelation of Ezra, because it's very much like the book of Revelation. But the others are about how God speaks in everyone, and they're very different. And that kind of understanding of what the Christian message was completely buried by the 4th century. And I think it's significant. I think it's a part of this tradition that we might consider engaging.
Elaine Pagel, thank you so much.
Elaine Pagel's latest book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She's the Harrington Spear Payne Professor of Religion at Princeton University. Our conversation was recorded on stage at the Milwaukee Public Library's Centennial Hall earlier this year. The Rotary Club of Milwaukee looks back at its first century and looks forward as it works to stay relevant. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The Rotary Club of Milwaukee is celebrating its centennial anniversary this month. The local branch of the service organization was founded just 8 years after the international organization was begun, making it one of the longest operating chapters in the world. While much about the group and Rotary has changed, leaders of the group say much remains the same as well. Rick White is the current president of Milwaukee Rotary. He and member Joanne Anton join me in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having us. This is great to be here.
It's a treat. Thank you.
What is the story of Milwaukee Rotary circa 2013? Where are you today versus where Rotary has been in the past?
Well, we've been celebrating this year because we have a pretty rich history in the community, certainly in terms of service to the community, but also as a place where people come, where issues are discussed, where we learn about what's going on, and it's a very exciting place to be because everyone who's in Rotary is really a leader in their profession in some way.
I just think the ideals of Rotary keep it relevant, justifies its existence year in and year out. And I would say today, 100 years later, it's as relevant, if not more, because of its ideals.
Well, talk about those ideals. What are those ideals as you see them, and how do they speak to who each of you are?
I think I like to describe them as very simple and sincere ideals. Rotary has a four-way test, and above and beyond that, just believes in some very key fundamental things of fellowship, friendship, service above self. That is our motto. And finding ways to really contribute to the surrounding community, but also the world.
I think Joanne touched on service above self. That's been the Rotary motto for a long time. And if you think how Rotary was first begun, a group of business people getting together who are interested not only in business and business relationships, but they have something that's a cut above that's a little different. And that is, how can we make the place that we live a better place? So they're focused not only on business and business relationships and policies and issues of the day, but also focused on making that community, wherever it may be, a better place to be. And as Rotary has grown over the last 100 years and has become an international organization, That is true not only in local communities around the world, but it's certainly true internationally. And we also try to make the world a better place, it's sometimes in big ways, sometimes in small ways. But at the end of the day, it's always looking toward the future and always looking to say, well, what can we do that's a little bit better?
This is an era when there are a million different networking opportunities, many of them virtual, whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter or any number of ways that people have of staying in contact with each other and leveraging each other's support. Why is it still important in 2013 for people to physically be in the presence of other people and doing the kinds of things that, that Rotary does?
Well, I think a couple of things. You can absolutely establish a relationship online, a digital relationship. But there's something about knowing that other person, knowing how they're going to react, knowing who you can go to in a particular situation. As things come up, the relationships that Rotary allows you to establish give you that edge. I'm going to go to Joanne instead of Mitch because Joanne is a person I know who's passionate about this particular issue. And the other thing is, frankly, you know you can who you can count on. And the nice thing about Rotary is I know I can go to any Rotarian because of the type of person that is in the Rotary Club, and I can count on that person.
Rotary is tangible. Some of those other things you mentioned are somewhat intangible, can't be touched, can't be felt, and everything about Rotary is upfront, close, personal. We take on ownership of issues, of our community, of each other, and we're all the better for it. We sort of lose ourselves in the organization but find ourselves at the same time.
After 100 years of existence, can you point to the tangible evidence that's out there of the impact Rotary has had on the Milwaukee community?
Sure. I'll give you a couple of examples in the past, and then we can go to one that's really current and is something we're very, very excited about. But for example, Rotary has been on the forefront of a number of things here in the community. If you look at Feeding America, that started as Second Harvest. That was a Rotary project. If you look at the Low Vision Clinic, that was a Rotary project. The Children's Health Education Center that Aurora runs, that was a Rotary project. Those are things that have been in the community that Rotarians said, hey, there's a need there. Maybe we can get something going. Because one of the great strengths of Rotary is the ability to take an idea, take what Rotary and Rotarians can do as individuals and then leverage that to make a better thing. This is our 100th anniversary, so we wanted to have a 100th anniversary gift or project for the community. And in September 29th, will be the grand opening of the Rotary Club of Milwaukee Centennial Arboretum. We did this in partnership with the Urban Ecology Center, the Milwaukee Urban River Foundation, the River Revitalization Foundation, the city, the county, private landowners. Rotary put some money in there, and I'll tell you, we put $400,000 in there. The reality is this is an $8 million-plus project. So we were able to pull that together, and what we will give to the community on September 29th is something that will last for hundreds of years. It will greatly expand the Urban Ecology's ability to do outdoor education, but more, it will be a seed, a place where seeds from native species can be harvested and used throughout the state. And this is just going to be a wonderful place to go. It's down behind the Urban Ecology Center along the Milwaukee River and basically is going to create an oasis in the middle of the city. We think that's something that will improve the quality of life for a long time to come.
You both mentioned the notion that Rotary is just as relevant to life today as it was 100 years ago. Is there a challenge in getting that message out? Do you feel like you have to raise your voice a little bit to be heard over everything?
Well, I don't know if it's raising your voice, but you are absolutely correct. There are many, many outlets, ways to serve if you want, ways to get involved, ways to come together and develop relationships with others. Rotary is seen by many as, oh, this is old-fashioned, this is really kind of traditional, I want to do something else. But at the end of the day, Rotary and organizations like Rotary absolutely make a very tangible difference in the quality of life. I'll give you another example that is something that only Rotary can do. For example, in 1988, we declared war on polio. In 1988, you would have thought, hey, that's a disease that's been long gone since the 50s. In 1988, there were over 300,000 cases of polio worldwide, and that was silly. There was no reason for that. Rotary teamed with the World Health Organization, with the United Nations, and other organizations, and we decided this is stupid, and we're going to get rid of polio. And we've been on a tear to do that since that time. Last year, there were only 270 cases worldwide. We still have some ways to go, but we're very close now. That's the type of thing that only a club like Rotary can do, and at the same time, turn around and come to a place like Milwaukee and listen to the governor one week, listen to the mayor the next week, listen to a debate on a policy issue that's coming up. You know, that's the type of thing that Rotary can do that you don't find in too many other places.
And the best thing about Rotary is where others see challenges, we see opportunities. And so our club continues to adapt and evolve and really take advantage of some of the tools out there, but also really continue to invest and harness our greatest asset, which is our people and our membership. We're only as strong as the members that we have.
You mentioned the perception of Rotary as being old-fashioned. Is there a concerted effort to go out and find younger members?
Well, I think so, and a great example is the young lady sitting to my right here. Rotarians have typically been seen as the CEOs, the old-school type of individuals. In fact, we have a number of business owners in our club. We have a number of CEOs or chief professional officers of not-for-profits in the community. We have a number of executives from large businesses. But we have folks who are maybe not quite at that level yet who are coming along and will be the leaders recognized as tomorrow. Certainly, we want those individuals as well. Any club, any organization like that needs those individuals. We certainly would welcome those individuals as well.
And I want to make a plug for, I think one of the, there are so many cool things about Rotary, but one of the most intriguing is that we are worldwide. And so when you think about joining a club or endeavoring in any one particular direction, where else can you go where you are welcomed into 34,000 clubs all around the world? And anytime you step outside of your comfort zone or your geographic zip code, you can find friendship, fellowship, service above self in another club, whether it's in the zip code next door or in a country on the other side of the world.
Joanne, Anton, Rick White, thank you so much. Best of luck to you on this 100th anniversary.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rick White is the president of the Rotary Club of Milwaukee and a vice president at We Energies. Joanne Anton is a Rotary member and an assistant to former U.S. Senator Herb Kohl. There's a link to more about Milwaukee Rotary and its 100th anniversary from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Another break now, and then Lake Effect heads to the farm with writer Christy Athens. Stay tuned for that conversation coming up next. You're listening to WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Many people who live in the city or suburbs have had the somewhat romantic notion of giving up the rat race and buying a place in the country, maybe getting some chickens, growing some of your own food. It's tempting, especially after you've sat in rush hour traffic for a while. But what does it take to really make that pipe dream a viable option? Former Midwesterner Christy Athens and her husband thought they'd give rural life a try. They moved from Portland, Oregon to the Columbia River Gorge a few years ago. It turned out to be a challenging but rewarding period in their lives. And while they're back in the big city now, Athens has turned the experience into a recent book called Get Your Pitchfork On. She joined us via Skype last fall. Christy Athens, welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
Why did you and your husband do the proverbial move to the country when you did?
We had grown up in the suburbs. When we were young adults, we lived in Minneapolis proper, and then we lived in Portland. So we had done kind of the urban thing, and we were starting to get really aware of, you know, sort of the benefits of organic food, and just we loved hiking. One of the reasons we moved to Oregon in the first place was because we loved the outdoors so much, and it seemed like there was a lot of it out here, and we just started to feel like we wanted it to be more of a lifestyle and less of a weekend sort of excursion. And so we started looking at homes in the Columbia River Gorge, which is about an hour away from Portland, due east, and it's an amazing part of the country. If you've never seen it, I highly recommend a trip out here. It's a national scenic area, and it's just fantastic. And so it was close enough to Portland that we would be able to keep our jobs, but far enough away that we would be able to get some land.
Well, and this is a phenomenon or a sentiment that is not necessarily all that uncommon among people who grow up and live in cities or suburbs, this idea of trying to find someplace that they feel more connected to.
I think so, and I think it's partly a generational thing. I think it's partly an historical thing. This, you know, point in time in our history, we're really coming to a head with industrialization of everything. And you know, when things like nature and food get industrialized, it's you know, kind of puts a whole different weight on the benefits and the detriments. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people have similar impulses as we had.
At the same time, once you get past that impulse, do you find, is there a certain degree of presumptuousness that accompanies a move like this? I mean, you essentially write that you knew enough about what goes into farming and living in rural America that you didn't really know enough.
Absolutely. And I do want to make the distinction that we weren't farming. We talk about our place as a farm, but we weren't selling our produce or anything like that. But sort of the reason I wrote the book was I realized that the book that I really needed didn't exist yet. There were a lot of books that I have and I still have. Carla Emery's book is just celebrating its 40th anniversary, and it's a fantastic book. But you know, my generation, I say in the introduction to the book, you know, we're interested in being more connected to the land, but not interested in giving up things like the New York Times and good coffee. You know, there's certainly exceptions, but not quite as hardy as the 60s and 70s back to the land kids, because they were, you know, building their homes from scratch by themselves with no power tools. And I'm not going to do that. But there, you know, so there's this continuum of involvement in going back to the land, and the book that I needed to talk about internet and talk about telecommuting and talk about sort of local economies. They're, you know, not as vibrant as urban economies, and so as a freelance writer, I had a hard time getting enough work and getting paid well enough for it. And then the whole back fifth of the book is about the social part of living in the country. And that, to me, was the thing that I was least prepared for. I knew that I was going to have to do a lot of physical labor and carry 40-pound bags of chicken feed and all that stuff. But I didn't quite understand the magnitude of small-town politics and just being in a kind of a crucible when you're in a small town, because everyone knows everyone's business. And when there are disagreements and things like that, things can get ugly, and it's hard to get away from it.
So did you find that the physical stuff was the stuff that you were able to adapt to most easily versus the bigger, more nebulous things like small-town etiquette?
Yes, absolutely. One thing that we learned, you know, on the physical side, we're not very large, burly people, my husband and I. And so there were things that we really needed machinery to do that we didn't have. We really needed a compact tractor that would have made our lives a lot easier, but they're, you know, $25,000. So there was that aspect to it. But yeah, definitely the social part. I am, you know, I consider myself a fairly normal person, but I'm not mainstream, and I don't fit into mainstream culture very well. And, you know, in an urban area, that is less of an issue. And in a rural area, a lot of people feel threatened by anything that's different.
Well, and you're right that things as small as like finding a sports team to root for is an issue. And if for no other reason, then it gives you a starting point to have conversations.
Exactly. And I read about having kids. We did not have children. And that was also an issue that set us apart from everyone else as, you know, unusual or what's wrong with them or, you know, that kind of thing. And I recommend it in the book, if you don't have children, getting to know the high school sports teams anyway, just because it's such a nexus where people meet. You know, there's church and there's sports And those are kind of the things that bring, generally speaking, bring Americans together.
It seems there was no detail too small for you to include. And I wonder if that just speaks to the broader theme that perhaps people just don't realize how fundamentally different rural life is than life in the suburbs or the city.
Yeah, you know, I spoke from a lot from my experience. I did talk to a lot of people, and of course I knew Hood River and the Gorge being just an hour out of Portland. There are a lot of people from Portland and Seattle living there, and so my experience was, you know, replicated with other people as well, so I got to compare notes. But it was a unique experience, and it was a challenge in very specific ways, and so I tried to reflect that in the book.
We can't hope to even address a tiny fraction of the material that's in this book, but I'm curious to hear what the areas are in which you get the most questions from people when they find out what you've done, either the move to the country itself or find out that you've written this book. What are the areas that I think that you think are the most that people are the most curious about?
Well, it's been really interesting. The book's only been out since April, and I think it will, you know, sort of have a ripple effect, and people will keep discovering it. People ask me a lot about the physical stuff. I think that urban people, even reading the book, don't fully appreciate that back chapter, and so you only accept information that you want. You know what I mean? And so I think that back part will come in handy for people because they are able to put their minds around, you know, the physical stuff. And then later they'll say, wow, this is really a challenge. And then they'll be able to go back to the book.
Well, and I wonder if the sheer heft of the book or the sheer length of the book itself might be serve as a good warning to people to think something like this through seriously without just saying, hey, we really ought to move to the country.
Yeah, well, that was definitely my goal, is to just give people the book I wish I had, but give them as much information, not in, you know, although there are a lot of details, I don't go into any one thing that deeply just because I wanted to keep it broad and just kind of make a checklist. Like, have you thought about wood? Have you thought about your septic system? Have you thought about where the sun rises and sets in the winter as opposed to in the spring when you're looking at the property? You know, I tried to be very broad and just, I didn't put any, chicken coop designs in the book because Lord knows you can get on the internet and find 50 different designs. So I tried to keep it broad, but be comprehensive in its breadth.
I'm laughing because that was exactly the example I was just about to cite, is that it seems that what you've done is you've given people an idea of the various things they need to think about, and then when they want to build their own chicken coop, they can find one of the 50 different designs that's on the internet or get a whole book about chicken coop design.
Exactly, and I would definitely recommend that. Anything that you want to specialize in, if you're interested in goats, do not rely on my little bit about goats, obviously. You know, get a couple of books that are focused on goats.
Do you have any regrets from those? It was 6 years you spent giving it your best shot?
Well, the main thing is that we want to do it again. So it's not a situation where we did it and it was like, oh, that was horrible, we'll never even go back there. We're trying to figure out how we can do it again, but to take all of, you know, these things to heart and do a better job next time and make it more sustainable.
Well, Christy Athens, thanks so much for sharing what you love about it with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christy Athens is the author of Get Your Pitchfork On, The Real Dirt on Country Living, part of the Process Media Self-Reliance series. She's a native Minnesotan with Wisconsin roots, but now lives in Portland, Oregon. Our interview first aired last fall, and you can find a link to much more about the book at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then a trip underground to one of Milwaukee's oldest places, but one of its newest concert venues. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. If you've ever taken the tour at the Miller Brewery, you've probably encountered the Miller Caves, a veritable underground bunker carved into the hill above State Street in the Miller Valley. The space is more than a century old, but it will soon be put to a use it's never held in those 100-plus years, that of a concert venue. The Pabst Theater Organization is pairing with Miller Coors to host the first-ever concerts at the Miller Caves in June. The two shows on June 16th will feature actor and musician John C. Reilly and friends. We traveled out to the Caves to get the full story from the Pabst's Andy Nelson and Kendra Lafersky of Miller Coors. Thanks for having me out here.
Well, thanks for coming down here. This is a very special place in Milwaukee, and we're excited to show it off.
Yeah, I mean, where are we? It feels like I'm like Indiana Jones, and we've like gotten into this hidden cave that I'm not supposed to be in. This place is amazing. It's gorgeous.
Well, and so that's a great place to start. Where are we? What are the Miller Caves? What are we doing here?
Well, the Miller Caves are one of the oldest areas that we have here, not only in Miller Coors here in Miller Valley, but also in Milwaukee. They were hand dug in the 1850s. And when Frederick Miller came here in 1855, he bought this cave as well as some of the other assets here in Miller Valley from Charles Best, who at that time owned the Plank Road Brewery.
And what were they used for originally?
Originally, this is where Frederick stored all of his beer. This was the only way that he could keep the beer cold, because at that time, back in the 1850s, mechanical refrigeration had not been invented. So what his brewery workers did is go chip ice and chunks of ice from area lakes and streams and brought that right in here. They covered it with sawdust and hay and were able to keep not only the caves but the beer cool all year round, especially in those hot summer days.
And at the moment, this is now part of the museum, if you will, or the what people would see on the tour?
Yes, it's the last stop on the Miller Brewery Tour. This is our marquee thing that we actually get to show people that come in from not only all over the United States, but all over the world. It's a unique, one-of-a-kind place and definitely the highlight of the tour.
Okay, so then the question is, whose idea was it to have a concert down here?
Well, that would be the Pabst Theater. We've been doing shows at the Pabst Theater for 10 years. Luckily to have, you know, someone like Michael Cudahy that took over such a historic venue in the city. But then there's places like this that exist in the city, too. I mean, this was hand-dug and created just 3 years after Milwaukee's inception. So it's like, you know, we can't go back to the existence of humanity and time, but you can definitely go back to the beginnings of Milwaukee. And if there's any place that's the beginning of Milwaukee, the Miller Caves are it. And so this is such, we already knew this to be such an immensely special place. And we've always wanted to do some sort of concert here, but then the right thing never came along. But then when a certain Mr. John C. Reilly, that many people know from Talladega Nights and Dr. Steve Brühl and so many other things, and he's done singing with in the movie Chicago and the Dewey Cox story, but he is this incredible folk singer. He has this band. He's going to be coming down here on Sunday, June 16th, already sold out, so you can't get your tickets anymore. But this is the very first concert that's, I believe, has ever happened here. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the first concert, certainly of its kind. Ironically, when the caves were finished being used for beer storage, once mechanical refrigeration came along, they were kind of closed down and not used for many years. In the 1950s, it was reopened by Frederick's grandson, Frederick C. Miller, and Liberace was actually here at the dedication for the museum at the time, and then the tour program was opened a short while later. But since that time, no musicians
Liberace didn't break out his piano, though?
No, I don't think so. I can't speak to it. I wasn't here at the time.
Well, so how receptive was Miller to the idea of putting on a show down here?
Absolutely receptive to it. This is just a phenomenal place, as Andy mentioned, and one of the coolest places you can find in Milwaukee anywhere. So for us to be able to partner with the Pabst and showcase this venue, but also looking towards the future of what we might potentially be able to do with the Pabst in the future, this is just a fantastic opportunity for everybody involved, including the folks that are going to attend.
So this is the first concert down here, but it's entirely possible that it is not the last.
Entirely possible.
Yeah, I mean, this is entirely impossible that it will not be the last. I mean, we're all of our organization, the Pabst Theater Organization, with running the Pabst Theater, with running the Riverside Theater, with running the Turner Hall Ballroom, all historical landmarks. That's what our organization is about. And Milwaukee, nationwide, is incredibly lucky to have these historical landmarks. I mean, there's great cities across the U.S., like, you know, Minneapolis and Portland and other cities like that, but they don't have all these historical buildings like we do here in Milwaukee, and we have to take advantage of that. And this is a way of extending our business and going out into places like the Miller Caves. It doesn't get any better than this. And doing something special. It's not about making money. Trust me, we're never going to make money. There's 100-person capacity down here. There's definitely going to be beer for sale, but, you know, no one's making money on this. This is about offering something, an experience to the community that is like no other place in the entire world.
What are the logistical challenges in putting on a show down here? This was obviously not designed for the acoustics.
Well, not originally, no. Obviously, Frederick Miller had a much different plan in mind for this space. So logistically now, the size, you know, we would love to invite more than just 100 people per show, but unfortunately that's just not physically possible. Acoustically, we've done some treatments here in the caves that will enhance the sound once we get the band in here, so we're pretty excited about it. And then, you know, beer service, we don't have a big bar down here, but we've got some very unique ways to actually serve our beers down here. And because this is such a new opportunity for us, we definitely were going to be able to showcase some of our newer beers that we have, like Batch 19 and Third Shift and Red's Apple Ale. So it should be a really good time and just a really different way to do this kind of concert.
Is there a concern? Because obviously the Pabst and the Riverside in particular are known for being really amazing concert venues. Are there concerns that the Pabst has about making this sound as good as any concert? I mean, it's obviously going to sound unique.
Yes, it is going to sound unique. I would answer that with a very blunt no. We aren't concerned. However, we're going to be very adamant about making it the best possible. But let's be realistic. This isn't about making it the greatest sounding ever. But however, as they said, they have worked on the sound. So I think it's going to sound phenomenal in here. But regardless, I mean, if you're seeing, you know, have the opportunity to see, like, Paul Simon in, like, a sewer, that's going to be amazing because of that experience. And that's what it's about. And this is going to be unlike anything else. And so, but at the same time, it's an adventure. You know, we don't know what's, you know, maybe something will be terribly wrong. Everything will go terrible. But I think it's going to be phenomenal. And that's what makes it exciting, that we're taking this huge risk. Let's bring a world-famous actor and a phenomenal musician in this cave that we have in Milwaukee.
Right.
And we think that's great. That's taking risk, and that's doing something that's exciting. It's real easy to put on a phenomenal-sounding concert in the Pabst Theater. The acoustics there are real easy to get. It's going to be a challenge for our sound guys, but I think we're up for the challenge.
We've actually had a few acoustical artists in here for different venues that we have. We do a lot of beer food pairing dinners in here. And, you know, this cave actually enhances the sound in many ways. So I'm actually looking forward to it. I think it's going to be pretty cool.
How did you pitch the idea to John C. Reilly?
Well, actually, he plays, people probably don't know this, but he actually plays really unique venues all across the world. He likes to play these, like, abandoned small churches and chapels and cathedrals. Just earlier this year, he did this, like, last-minute show in the center of London in some cathedral. It was just, like, 2 weeks prior, he's like, I'm coming to London. We're going to do this incredible show in this weird place. And so that's what he does. He does that, and then he'll play really cool music festivals like Sasquatch and Pitchfork and things like that. But he doesn't want to play these big, huge, you know, he probably won't be playing at the Pabst or the Riverside. He likes to play these weird, strange places and try out his music, because obviously that is not his number one thing that he's doing in his life. So he likes to offer his cool, unique experiences. So I can tell you that he is beyond excited. It's not just we've signed the contract with this manager. John C. Reilly really is just absolutely jazzed to be coming to Milwaukee and playing in such a unique venue. And I would imagine this is the most unique place that he's ever played in.
How much amplification are you going to have to do? This is really not a very large space.
Not much. I mean, it won't be no amplification. We certainly will have amps here. I mean, almost no one does just straight up acoustic guitar and no amps anymore. But, you know, with 100 people in here, it won't be having be that much since we are in this cave in small space.
And standing show a la Turner?
Yes. Yeah, it'll be mostly standing, yeah.
Some of the cool things people can see, though, while they're standing up and walking around the room is you've got Frederick's personal beer bottle collection down there near the front. And then when the caves were reopened in the 1950s, there were Cooper's tools found in here. And so we've got those on display on the wall. So there's always a lot of cool things to walk around and see in here, even in this space.
You anticipated my next question. The beer bottles are not moving for the concert.
Nope. They stay on. There's a light in there in that display case, and people can kind of go up and see what beers actually existed. That's his personal collection from here in Wisconsin, so many of those beers in that case don't exist anymore.
This is an exciting time?
Oh, very exciting time. We've had tremendous feedback, and it's just the beginning, so very excited.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the honor to work at a place that in college I just ended up loving in the Pabst Theater. I've been working there for 5.5 years. And this might be the most, or definitely in the top three, coolest things that my organization has ever done. I mean, we've done stuff with Fish Fry and a Flick on the lakefront. Like Lebowski Fest is coming up again. And been able to see David Byrne in the Pabst Theater. Things that, like, personally I geek out about. This might be the best thing, coolest thing we've ever done. I can't wait for it.
Well, thank you, both of you, and best of luck with the show.
Yes, thank you very much, Mitch.
Thank you so much.
Andy Nelson of the Pabst Theater Organization and Miller Coors Guest Relations Manager Kendra Lafersky talked with us from the Miller Caves underneath the hillside along State Street. The Caves will host their first ever concerts June 16th, featuring John C. Reilly and friends. The show will also feature the Caves' distinctive fountain in a new capacity, as Lafersky explains.
When we did the renovations in the Caves 5 years ago, we also renovated this fountain and added this very cool, very old tap handle as the fountain spout. So,
and with that noise in the back of our head, that is Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another episode of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.